This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we have a conversation to continue our conversations about active shooter preparedness here in Northwest Indiana. We'll talk with Portage Police Chief Troy Williams about that and a series of workshops that his department's working on for next month to be able to train better for active shooting preparedness issues. Also, too, we'll talk with Chancellor Louis Gonzalez from Ivy Tech Community College in Gary about the Gary campus closing out the old building on 35th Avenue and making some shifts to a new building and a better facility. We'll also bring you another edition of Green Fleet Radio with Carl Lissick. That and more coming up, but first the news. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We're continuing with our conversation concerning active shooter preparedness here in Northwest Indiana. We've already chatted with Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez about it. Now let's turn to Portage Police Chief Troy Williams. There is a very special project that he and his department have coming up here very soon, dealing with the issue of active shooter, and he's joining us on the program today. Thanks for being with us, Chief.
Happy to be here. Thank you, Chris.
Well, we know that it seems like in this day and age, you just can't know exactly what's going to happen in public. Is active shooter preparedness becoming a bit more of what you think might be our new normal?
You know, unfortunately, I think it is. You know, obviously, given the events that happened in Parkland, Florida, very tragic. You know, that very next morning, we had reports of two adults carrying guns near one of our middle schools. Took us a little while to find them. There's some dense fog that morning, and so we had some schools go on a lockout just as a precaution. But once we located them, and there were BB guns, but they looked real as could be. And just given, you know, unfortunately, the world we live in today, you can't be too cautious on something like this.
With the situation being as it is, and like you say, you've had this one scare, basically, that happened right after the shooting there to your department. There have been other departments here in Northwest Indiana that have had similar scares as well, too, about the same time, I understand. How should we respond when there is an active shooter in our vicinity?
Well, each, you know, school districts or, you know, I would imagine most businesses, for that matter, if you look nationally, I mean, stuff like this, they've happened at a concert venue, a movie theater, on a baseball field.
Right.
Understanding the protocols and the safety plans of where you work, be it a school or a particular office building of some sort, knowing what the escape routes are or the exits and entrances of places, whether it's in a restaurant, you know, being aware of your surroundings, just, you know, having an idea what you would do in a given situation. You want to talk to your family, your kids, you know, if you're a teacher, the students. Just, you know, it's a conversation you need to have and you need to talk about, because unfortunately these things are all too common.
Do you think that it's a good idea to have a family plan, certainly of this sort?
Absolutely. Yeah. We're hosting a active shooter survival workshop marketed toward, you know, school employees. We've got our own schools. We've got schools from Gary, Crown Point, Lake Station, Valpo, Chesterton, I think even Chicago, I've registered to attend. So, you know, this is to teach some basic concepts of what you probably already know, but, you know, in a stressful situation, you start to get tunnel vision, and remembering to do the things that you've been trained to do, or if you've not been trained, to understand what you need to do in a given situation.
I know there's been discussion and some comment as well, too, ever since, in particular, since the Parkland, Florida situation happened, that there's been a kind of a description that there are ways to try to think ahead and deal with these things, and it's been kind of characterized in three words: run, hide, and fight. Would you kind of give us your idea of how this seems to play out?
I mean, yeah, the concept is, you know, if you have a active assailant or shooter, you want to get away from the area. You know, the schools, you know, have, you know, lockdown plans, and I mean, those are important. You know, if you run from, you know, a hallway to the outside, you know, how do you know that a shooter's not outside? So, I mean, they need to follow the school safety plans. You know, when you get to a place, you want to hide. You know, we talk about cover and concealment.
Mm-hmm.
Concealment is something that can hide you, but not necessarily stop a bullet. Cover, you know, like a wall that can block a bullet. And then the fight, you know, when faced with a situation, you know, someone's coming into your classroom, your office, your business, you know, if you have no other route to escape or, you know, a way to defend yourself, what are you prepared to do? And no one will probably really know that until they find themselves in those situations. But, you know, if you've got putting a book bag in front of you would be better than not having something.
Right.
Or throwing a book, or, you know, if you have access to a fire extinguisher, or, you know, a chair blocking doors. So, I mean, there's many different things that we can talk about and we will talk about. But again, unfortunately, in today's world, these are the conversations you need to have with your family, you know, and how would you respond to something like this?
You mentioned earlier here about the importance of having such a plan, not only set up certainly for a school or a school district for that matter, but a private business or a public business for that matter. You deal up with issues, perhaps in county government or local government, that something can happen there too. So you have to be prepared for those eventualities there, which I would imagine.
Absolutely. This isn't confined to just, you know, schools, although they have happened a lot at schools and, you know, those receive a lot of attention by the media. But if you look around the country, you know, over the last, you know, 15 years or so, these things have happened at concert venues, in movie theaters, you know, restaurants, baseball fields with the shooting of the Republican congressman.
Right.
So, you know, you want to feel safe in your environment. One of the things to be able to feel safe in the environment is understanding how you would respond if something were to happen. So it can be simply as just think in your mind, what would I do if this happened? And there's no end to what ifs. You can always play out a scenario. So if you run through these things in your mind, these scenarios, you know, over time, you know, every day, when something happens, you're going to be more apt to be able to handle it a lot better.
We're talking with Portage Police Chief Troy Williams. The Portage Police Department is going to sponsor a special two-hour-long workshop on March 13th and again on March 20th and also in April as well, too, to be able to train better the situation that police departments and individuals can run into with an active shooter situation that may come up. And I understand, too, that you're going to have, you mentioned some of the departments are going to be involved in this as attendees, and I know that they're going to probably have some great expertise in handling things like first aid. That's always, I know, a problem, obviously, if you do have an active shooter situation. You've got people, if they're rushing out of the building or they're injured somehow in the building, you've got to get them the first aid that they possibly can get, as well as still probably dealing with a shooter walking through a building.
Absolutely, and that's one of the things we are going to talk about. You know, if someone's bleeding, how do you apply direct pressure? You know, is a tourniquet needed? So, I mean, obviously, we won't have doctors here, but we'll give them some basic concepts so that they can utilize and research on, you know, on their own sometime to understand what you can do to assist in a situation like this.
It sounds like that you've done the best you can to be able to help prepare people if they aren't already prepared, or certainly to refresh their memory on how things are handled as well. Are you hoping that we maybe are training people for something that we hope will never, ever happen?
I'd rather train and be prepared and it never happen than have it happen and never have trained. As a side note, we've got about 140 people registered for over these four classes so far, and we still have seats available.
That's great. That's great. That's nice to know. And you can always find out more by contacting the Portage Police Department to find out about the classes and the workshops set up here. We're talking with Portage Police Chief Troy Williams about the series of workshops that he and his crew are going to be putting on here for a number of organizations here to be able to train people better prepared for any active shooter incidents that may happen here in Northwest Indiana. And Chief, thanks very much for being with us. Appreciate the information.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Ivy Tech Community College here in Northwest Indiana has campuses, of course, in many places, Crown Point, East Chicago among them, and Gary. And only one is going to change location. And to find out more about that, let's turn to the Chancellor, Luis Gonzalez. Chancellor Gonzalez, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
If you will explain, I guess, some of the thinking and the planning behind a decision to be able to shift the campus in Gary around from one location to another. And we're talking about taking the longtime building on 35th Avenue and shifting those operations over to the new location, part and parcel of IU Northwest.
Chris, you said something that that I think that people can relate to. We've been there. There's one building on 35th Avenue. We've been there since, I believe, early or mid-60s, 1960s, so mm-hmm. it gives you an idea how long we've been in there, and with people, it's the ones who, I'm dating myself now, there was at one time trailers that were actually, that were near that older building, that what we call the South Building.
Right.
And over the years, it has evolved, the newer building, the North Building, was built in the 1990s. But as times have changed, and we made the commitment to be down the street at IUN, the new IUN Arts and Sciences Building. It's a beautiful building on the corner of 35th and Broadway. We partnered with IUN, and so we've expanded our offerings there. So we will be offering chemistry and biology majors there as well. And so, and then it was decided that our footprint would change. And so, since we're going to be offering a majority of our classes over at the new Arts and Sciences Building, and our technology programs, we can move actually across the street. We can repurpose the buildings and the land that we currently are located in. Certainly, we're there to do what's best for the city of Gary. We shouldn't be defined by a building or two, it should be defined by our commitment. And so that's what we're looking at and how we better make use of the space that we have. And it goes back to what our president said to us and indicated that, you know, we're there to look at our square footage. You know, are we maximizing the use of our square footage? Is it worth our while in terms of are we saving the taxpayer dollars? And so that was all considered. And so that's one of the reasons why we made a decision to change the footprint.
You mentioned briefly here some of the programs that Ivy Tech Community College offers that they are going to be relocated or are, if they haven't already, will be into the Arts and Sciences Building. What else do you hope that Ivy Tech Community College can take away from the opportunity to be so close to the IU Northwest campus?
We have a program, it's called the ABC program, and ABC stands for Associate Plus Bachelor's Equals Career. And so that's an agreement that was put together in place with IUN and some of the Northern Indiana Ivy Tech campuses. And so basically what that is that you would complete your studies, your associate degree at Ivy Tech, and if you would consider attending Indiana University, Northwest, that you would, or Kokomo or the South Bend campus, you could participated in the summer bridge program, and then all these credits would transfer over to IUN. And so again, we're making better use of the space that's being provided for us. But you know, like in real estate, you know, they say what location, location, location to be given access to right on the corner of 35th and Broadway, which I believe is the gateway. Right off the interstate, off 8094, as you come in down Broadway, and to partner with IU, a fine institution like Indiana University Northwest, and to have access to all those students and the traffic that's there, it would be beneficial to the college, and so it really would be a win-win for us. And so our students love it. This past fall, we began with 29 classes, and we're up to 102 this spring, and we hope to double that for this coming term, this coming fall term.
Wow, that's great. That's great. When you talk about the relocation need that comes about when you deal with an older building, like the building on 35th has been there since 1968, what kind of maintenance problems, I suppose, more than anything else, that preclude the need to have to try and fix up a building? It's better to move into a new building.
It's like anything else. It's, you know, when individuals have to make decisions, whether it's a vehicle that had seen its better days or a home that has seen its better days, and you have to make decisions. Is it worth your while to continue to invest money in a vehicle or in a home or an apartment? Is it worth your while? And so we had to start making hard decisions about that sort of thing. We were putting just an inordinate amount of money in terms of repairs when it came to like heating and air issues, air conditioning issues. It was constant, and it wasn't fair to our staff and to our students who had to deal with that and grapple with that from time to time, dealing with air conditioning issues, heating issues. And there were times when I would actually walk through the building, and you see staff in overcoats during the wintertime. That's, again, that's not fair to them, and certainly not fair to our students.
Now, when we talk about shifting some programs currently at the Ivy Tech Community College building on 35th over to the Gary Area Community Gary Area Career Center, what types of programs do you think that Ivy Tech can benefit from that shift?
You know, what we're looking for, because our technology programs are housed in that same building that we were just referring to. So the space is very limited there. It's very tight. So I'll give you an example. Our welding labs, we offer a number of welding courses there. But the challenges that we have there is space. And so the sections are small. We can't really expand the way we would like to. We have workforce alignment courses, which are your non-traditional training courses in welding that could not be offered because of space. Going right across the street, literally going across the street at the Gary Career Center, those problems are disappear because they have ample space. And so that's the reason why that drew our attention to the Gary Career Center. And so Michelle Meadows, who's the executive director there, has been more than gracious to allow us to walk through the building, and a number of our cabinet has gone through the building, and they see what I see. There's a lot of potential there.
That's great.
And room for expansion, especially when it comes to training.
Now, I have to ask you, Delphi, as we kind of wrap our conversation up for now, we have this building that soon will be vacated. Everything shifted around to other locations. What kind of efforts are underway to make sure that the city of Gary doesn't end up with another building that's vacant and can't be reused? Is there anything that Ivy Tech is working out with the city of Gary to prevent that kind of problem from happening?
Oh, yes. We're a good neighbor. I've met with the mayor. I've assured her that we're not going to abandon the building, own the property. We're there to repurpose the property. And so we've been already contacted by some organizations, some businesses about selling the property. And so we will look at all offers, and we will entertain all these offers. And then I'm sure with our legal department, we will look at all that and then and look at what's best for not only the college, but also what's best for the communities. We're there to be a good neighbor, and we are not there to abandon the property. In no terms are we going to do that.
Ivy Tech Community College Northwest Indiana Chancellor Louis Gonzalez, thanks for being with us, and I hope that everything goes well, and we'll be back with you for an update here sometime soon.
All right. Thank you, Chris.
That's Northwest Indiana Chancellor for Ivy Tech Community College, Louis Gonzalez. You're listening to Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time now for Green Fleet Radio, and here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction, and today our guest is Mr. Doyle Summerall. He's the Managing Director for the NTEA, the Association for the Work Truck Industry. Doyle, welcome to the show.
Hey, Carl. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Doyle, tell our listeners, what is the NTEA?
Carl, we're a trade association, as you know, located in Michigan headquarters. We are all aspects of the industry that are trucks built in multiple stages, so the plow trucks and the delivery trucks that come to your house. We've got a little over 2,000 members, and we've been around since 64.
Wow, that's a long time.
Yeah.
So what are some of the trends you're seeing in the work truck industry, Doyle, when it comes to sustainable transportation options?
You know, it's really interesting. I think we've seen electric as a real push by the last administration, and then this administration has kind of dropped off in that regard. But industry itself has continued. We learned a lot with hybrids, and one of the really impressive things that came out of hybrids was workplace operation with the engine off. And a lot of people call that PTO.
Okay.
But it really goes well beyond that today, from powering basically lights when a truck's sitting on the side of the road to operating the bucket of the crane electrically. It has a lot of following. It's got good traction in the industry. The traction drive, full electric trucks are a little more challenging. It takes a lot of power to move a big work truck around, and so we're not seeing that come on as strongly as perhaps maybe in cars, but some hybrids. The other thing in a recent study we've just done, we see a real interest in biodiesel. So diesel, as we know, is say 65-70% of the sales and might be 80% of the population out there. And by going to biodiesel, you have a green bent on that. It's a little better for the environment. and it's pretty smooth. I mean, you don't have to change a lot of things in your operation, and you get that range and power that you need.
Sure. No, that's exciting stuff, Doyle. And I know there's, we read every day about some of the challenges that are facing the work truck industry's move to sustainable transportation. Can you talk about that just a little bit?
Sure. Trucks for industry are a tool. It's very different than your personal car. You buy a car, you buy it with personal preferences and maybe a little bit of lifestyle choice.
Mm-hmm.
For professional businesses, they're buying a tool. And so these are specifically tailored to their needs. And that becomes, whether we like it or not, an economic decision. It's part of their competitive edge in the industry. Certainly being sustainable has a market value as well. But with fuel being very inexpensive, it makes the payback on some of these technologies a little more challenging.
Sure. So I know you have one of the biggest and one of the best events that we attend. It's the Work Truck Show and Green Truck Summit coming up in Indianapolis this year. So tell our listeners a little bit about that event.
Well, great of you to ask about that, Carl. And you're right, we're in Indianapolis. It's going to be March 6th. We'll do the Green Truck Summit, which is an all-day event. Focuses on sustainability. We're very fortunate this year as the keynote. We have Terry Schaefer, who mm-hmm. is the strategic general manager for Daimler Trucks. This is a follow-up to their top engineering guy, Wilford, who spoke last year. They're going to talk a lot about where they're going and what they're thinking. And we'll follow on with the thing that we had last year, which was an effective and efficient path to zero emissions. And this year, there's going to be a lot of presentations, a lot of insights around what the industry and fleets are doing in this low-fuel environment to continue their sustainable march. We're seeing a lot of good things, a lot of electrification of systems, deployment of the fuels technologies, as we were just talking, and a number of other things. The Work Truck Show itself, we are blessed to have about 11,000 industry professionals attend, hundreds of trucks on the floor. Your organization is going to be doing a meeting there, and I think that's going to be very interesting. And, of course, we've got the IDEM folks from Indy. We're going to talk a little bit about the VW funds that are coming out. So you and I could spend an hour talking about
absolutely.
All we can do there.
Well, I think the interesting part, though, Doyle, is I think, this event is open to everyone, anyone that's interested in any trucks. If you have any questions, who are some of your followers of this, Doyle? I mean, basically, it's anybody that wants to drive a work truck. Are you still doing the, you're going to still have the ride and drive event? And
Absolutely. Ride and drive is going to be a lot of fun this year. Workhorse is going to demonstrate their horse fly, drone delivery technology three times a day on Wednesday and Thursday. We have six or seven OEMs doing new truck reveals. We get several thousand fleet managers there looking at this new equipment, talking about their experiences with fuels and equipment, and, of course, hundreds of trucks on the floor. The ride and drive gets you the opportunity to go out and actually get hands-on and drive one of these vehicles there on the Indy streets and learn about the technology from the professionals. So just an awful lot of really exciting things happening this year.
Sure. And it's definitely an international show held right here in Indianapolis. So how do listeners learn more about how to find out about the Work Truck Show and Green Truck Summit?
Well, if they go to worktruckshow.com, they'll find all of the schedules, everything about what's going on, who the key speakers are, and of course, they can connect with your organization and get a prepaid pass that will get them into the show at no charge and allow them to go to one of the concurrent educational sessions. So I think going to your Clean City site or to the Work Truck Show site, both will provide them with a lot of information.
And, Doyle, we're really looking forward to this event. We love working with you and your organization and all the different members of the NTEA, and that will do it for today's edition of the Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Doyle Summerall, Managing Director for the NTEA, the Association for the Work Truck Industry. And Green Fleet Radio airs three times every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us, and remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy. Thank you.
And podcasts of Green Fleet Radio are also available online on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Just search for WLPR. Lakeshore Focus host Keith Kirkpatrick recently had in the Lakeshore PBS studio two women to talk about a topic that could be best described as from girls to women, growing up the hard way. And here's the conversation.
When you hear the term boys to men, you probably think of the singing group that produced some sweet sounds. Cool name and a solid concept, boys growing into men. How about girls to women? Why doesn't that resonate in some way? Girls grow into women. Maybe society sends a different message to girls. On our show today, we have two women who are working with girls or young ladies. What are they facing and how do we help them become strong, empowered women? Let me introduce Kelly Fair, who is the founder and executive director for Polished Pebbles Girls Mentoring Program, and Cherise White, founder and chair of the ECIER Foundation. So, glad to have you both on here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Yeah. Glad to be here.
So I had to get through that E-C...
A-C-I-E-R.
Is that how you pronounce it?
That's how you pronounce it.
Okay, so I just kind of spelled it out for people. So they'll maybe remember it that way. So I figured you guys would be on here for two reasons. Your expertise, both you work with young ladies and trying to help them. And at one point you were young ladies, right?
Right.
So you went through some of this stuff. We're not going to ask how long ago that was, okay?
Okay.
So we're going to just let everybody can guess. So just maybe give me a reference point or give our viewers a reference point as to what you're doing working with these young women. Cherise?
Okay. Well, our foundation, we work with young women and young men in high school and teaching them, empowering them how to be innovators and entrepreneurs. And not, of course, encouraging them to go off to school, but when they go off to school, after college, they're looking for a job. So some of these students nowadays are so innovative, and we work with them on their projects and helping them with a product or a service. And that's what we do.
Okay. And you work in a little different way with girls, right?
Sure. So with Polished Pebbles, we focus on girls being great communicators at home, school, and the future workplace, hoping that will help to ensure their employability in the future workplace. So when we say we want girls to be great communicators, we work with about 400 to 500 girls a school year in Chicago and some here in Northwest Indiana. It means that they know how to introduce themselves to someone new for the first time. Seems really simple, but SHINING is an acronym. SMILING is the S, H for hello, I for introduce, and given three facts, N for nodding your head, and E for ending a conversation.
You guys, you got all these little clever things. Do these work with the kids?
But you know what? Yeah, and the kids say things like, oh, that's the formula for a really great presentation. Mm-hmm. So if it's the formulas, it's the catchy things, we all do, young mm-hmm. or old, that help us remember some of those most critical learning points.
Well, let's go back to, let's start at the starting point with this. I wanted people to have a reference as to what you were doing, but mm-hmm. what's it like today for a young woman growing up in our society? I mean, what are the challenges they face? Just, they're probably like this many, right? Mm-hmm. But I mean, give our viewers kind of a feel for what it's like growing up as a girl today.
Sure.
Go ahead.
I think it's some of the things that, you know, we talk about what was it like when we were young or just different generations. I think some of those things are still the same. It's still a foundation. Adolescence, it's just a time, you know, true thing. Your parents, your mom, they're going to get on your nerves sometimes, you know, or you woke up on the wrong side of the bed and you're in a funk. For us with Polished Pebbles, we call it the other side of the crisis, is recognizing many of our girls make it to school with a bad attitude because of those basic things that every kid goes through. But we know that they're facing high levels of trauma in their homes and in their communities before they even hit the school doors. They're growing up in the same homes in the communities that many of our boys are, and that we become a lot more aware of and conscious of the challenges for growing up in trauma communities or violence for boys, but we're not thinking about what it looks like for girls and what that impact is. So that walk from home to school, she may have seen and experienced things that no kid should have, no adult adult should have. That means that she got to school and she pushed, or she went off on the girl sitting next to her, or had a bad or nasty attitude with the principal or a teacher. But my gosh, if you only understood the things that she may have seen or experienced in her home. So we kind of seek to help her provide that voice to be able to express, hey, I'm experiencing this, I'm experiencing that, but also just kind of educate the larger community to look beyond and peel the layers back and look beyond the loudness or the attitude or the seeming despair and understand what she may really be experiencing.
Okay, there was a lot to dissect there, so I'm going to try to dissect a little of that.
Sure.
So we've got these two pieces you're saying. One is just girls grow up with the normal challenges of kids growing up,
right.
And some of those same things for boys and so forth. That's just kind of normal growing up kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But some kids really face some difficult traumas in their life, and there's things going on. And that's just not urban setting. That's today. It seems to be every place.
Right.
Challenged environments are challenged environments. What are some of those other kind of normal things, Charisse, do you think that particularly girls are facing?
Peer pressure. One, at school, the dress, what, you know, how they dress.
Do you think it's higher
than
boys, peer pressure?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes. Because, you know what, girls want to be liked. They want to be loved. Some have issues at home with not being treated well, not being able to do some of the things that they like to do. So a lot of that is the peer pressure, not being able to do as their friends, or being able to go certain places and their environment in which they live. So it forms some challenges. And then sometimes they run into being with issues with gangs. Mm-hmm. And as you say, getting in and out of their environment in their neighborhood, sometimes, depending on where they live, that can be very challenging. And that's, as when we were growing up, we didn't have to face that as much, whereas now it's, you know, prevalent. One, trying to get to school and learn, and then one, getting to school, then are you going to be able to get home and not be killed? You know, facing all with the gun violence, that's just a lot that they have to go through.
Are most of the kids you're working with living in urban settings? I mean, that's kind of where you guys are focused right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
The majority, but I mean, even some in some of the suburban settings as well, they're facing some of the same things. Even if it's things not at home or at school, the media. I mean, and when you're looking at girls and you think about the peer pressure and the self-esteem, a lot of it is tied into the imagery and the media and the pressure to look a certain way or dress a certain way or weigh or have a certain body image. Those are some of the things that they're dealing with as well. So, and that, the media is hitting girls all over, urban, rural, suburban, all types of places. So they're contending with a lot. And then the other thing that girls face at a higher level than boys as well is sexual abuse. And so when you look at, for some of the girls that we serve, sex trafficking numbers, and sex trafficking is not something that when we watch, you know, primetime TV law shows, they make us feel like it's something that only happens with immigrants, you know, young European women. But the reality is the largest group of sex trafficked women in the United States are women of color as well. So it's just all these different layers of things that they're dealing with that when a girl presents herself, you have no idea, you know, the barrage of imagery and experiences that help produce this child that may be having challenges in school.
So this pressure words keeps coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like, I mean, there's forces coming every direction that are really bombarding these young ladies.
Mm-hmm.
And so that probably explains why we see that little attitude. I mean, so how does that kind of translate? You both talked about how, so what we see sometimes is this sassy, smart-mouthed, you know, irreverent young woman. So you think that's directly coming from that rebellion and why, or from that reaction to that pressure? Where's that coming from?
You know, that's also, again, within their environment, the people that they're around, and also drugs. Some turn to drugs, you know, to help ease the pain and, you know, turn to little boys for love, and because they don't receive that at home. So what they don't receive at home, they look for it in the streets. So trying to, organizations like what she has and what I have and others, being able to reach out to these young ladies and say, you know what, we can help you make a difference. Some of them just need some TLC and they don't receive that. And you go that extra mile to be able to help them in a way that they don't receive at home. And we always say it starts at home. But if you don't receive that at home, then you're looking for it in the streets. And if you have someone that could properly and help mentor them in the right direction, you can help be able to save them.
So this pressure comes back to the self-esteem piece, and I think that's a strong part of what both of you try to do, is the self-esteem, confidence, being a strong person. So why is that really the foundation of what you're trying to do?
I mean, I think it's a core part of it. The confidence and the self-esteem and how you feel about yourself is always going to be the foundation. I think for some of the challenges that end up we see, there's additional need for skills and skill development. There's an additional need for career pathways and different things like that. So, you know, when we think about our girls and why they show up, they're fending people off. I mean, could you imagine? You're not only physically fending people off, you're physically fending off the ideas and the images that say everything that doesn't look, seem, and talk like you is better than you. That's a lot to deal with, but I think for us, it's the skill sets of, yes, having a confidence, but having really great communication skills that provide a pathway for you to, one, deal with your trauma, communicate, find your voice, connect with others, two, the communication skills that become the currency to take you into different communities and different opportunities, whether that be a career path of working as an employee somewhere else, whether that be becoming an entrepreneur. Learning how some of these basic skills will help transform you and take you out of where you are, but also provide you with this, the tools and the currency to go even further. So I think it's a need for talk about confidence and self-esteem, but you got to come with giving them ready tools and skills to really be able to cause and impact change.
That's a great differentiation, because you're right. If you help somebody's confidence go up and their self-esteem, they feel better about themselves, it's not going to really last very long if they can't find a job and they can't find a productive way to be part of society. And you're real focused on that with your program, right? I mean, that career pathing thing.
Right. And when she talked about basic needs, what's basic to us, sometimes it's not basic to them. Mm. Being able to teach them proper etiquette, what spoon to use, what fork to use, not always going out to fast food restaurants. Take a group of them to a very nice restaurant and prior teaching them which glass to use. You know, all that, what you feel is basic. To them, they don't understand. And if no one has ever taken the time to teach and train them that, then they wouldn't know. But it's very important as they're growing, you know, to be able to know those things. So for us, what is important is providing exposure, again, which is very small with us. You're taking students from, let's say, Gary, Indiana. There are some kids who have never even been to Chicago. You know, taking them over and exposing them to the restaurants and to the museums or to a play, to a theater. So, you know, training them now so when they're older, they, you know, would appreciate that, because that's sometimes that's not what they receive in school.
I think when people hear that, they find that a little hard to understand. So, I mean, you've got kids who've never been to a restaurant, have never been, I mean, how does that happen? And what else are they missing that just you're sometimes surprised at, like, wow, they've never been exposed to this?
I mean, I think it's a pure, it's almost like we have, as constituents and as people in the community, we need to almost do an economic field trip. Go into these neighborhoods, go into these communities and be very realistic and say, where would you go get a meal that you can sit down and have an etiquette session? They don't exist. There's one school leader, Cynthia Trevino, I think she is dynamic, and the metaphor that she uses for her kids is, how can they figure out where to go if they live in a neighborhood where there's no sidewalks? So where do you go even within your community or beyond to a Chicago or another metropolitan area if what's being communicated to you indirectly is there's nowhere to walk, there's nowhere to be, you know? So I think we have to really do a real survey of, where do we live? What are their real experiences? What's really available to them as resources? And say, how would you function in this environment? In Chicago, there were, some years ago, about 50 schools that were closed. Could you imagine walking to school if you were a kid and there are abandoned schools on your way to school? What message does that send to you about your value or your worth or where you can go?
You know, that really reminds me, because as simple as that sounds, walk through the neighborhood. I remember in high school, we were taken into New York as kids and walked through a poor neighborhood. It's eye-opening, because it's like, I'd never been in a place like that before. Mm-hmm. And you see, wow, broken windows, empty. How do people live here? And all of a sudden you can project some level of what it must be like to be here.
Right.
But if you've never seen that, you really don't know.
Okay.
So what else are they missing, Charisse? What are some of these other things you're like, wow, they just don't even get this?
Properly communicating to. Communication is the key, and resources. If you provide resources, as you said, you know, trying to get through neighborhoods, or if you're in an area where, you know, you don't have anyone that could help you with whatever that issue is, but, you know, having someone to come in to say, here's some resources where we can help you with whatever it is that student needs. And that's important, resources and communicating properly to help them as they're growing.
So you reminded me, I did an interview just recently of a high school student, and she was very soft-spoken, so it was hard to hear, so I was trying to help her with her communication. I said, so when you talk to your younger brothers, what kind of voice do you use with them? And her answer was, I scream and hit them. And I'm like, I was hoping she was going to talk loud voice, you know, or stronger voice. And she really didn't know what I was talking about. I mean, I think the change of having a higher level of communication for her, or powerful communication, was you yell and scream and hit. And I'm like, wow, that's interesting. If that was one of your students, what would you be doing to help them understand that there's some other possibilities here?
I mean, I think you have to role model for them and show there's different ways to deal with conflict, and it doesn't always have to include physical violence. It doesn't always have to include being loud. You know, it's having staff and people who do direct service and work directly with the kids to be able to talk about the diversity in their experiences as well. As, hey, I may have one experience and how I'm dealing with a conflict in my home or with my peers, but when I'm in business, there's different ways to kind of dealing with it. But I think one of the things that's critically important when you're teaching and working with any group of kids anywhere, but even with this demographic, is trust. And so you have to open up the door to even understand and help them recognize why she may be communicating in that way. If you've got a mom who's working two or three jobs, has very little time to actually be home with her kids or before she has to get to the next job, there may be a lot of frustration in that home. There may be a lot of lack of hope, which puts a mom to be in a position to say, sit down, shut up, don't move, because she's got an hour or 2 hours to flip before she gets to her next job. It's opening that line of communication and that level of empathy to that child to say, I can understand why that may be occurring, but let's think about how that may not work so well in this situation or that situation.
Does that take a long time to build, or is it just they're so hungry for it they want to jump in and grab a hold of it?
I think you're building trust in relationships, and any trust in relationships, regardless if it's romantic, an adult, or a kid, requires time. And I think sometimes for kids that have been let down so frequently, and not just by the people in their homes, but again, I think by let down by their communities and some of the leaders as well, it's tell me and show me that I really matter. And so sometimes it does take a lot of time to build that kind of relationship.
And it's repetitive. If that student is seeing you over a period of time, not just once or twice, and you're sharing with them, you know what, I need that information for me. So if you're continuously, you know, you're good, you're smart, you're sharing that over and over, then that trust, believe, you know what, she believes in me, mm-hmm. and I thank her for believing, because they need that. They need someone who believes in them. And when you talked about being able, their voice, she's talking to you in a lower pitch, and then later, you know, screaming and at her family. What we do is share with our students. We say, you know, because some of them come in and we say, you need to project your voice because, mm-hmm. you know, no one can hear you. You need to be able to project. So we always tell them, you know, here you're sitting in the front row. And let's just say if former President Obama or Jay-Z was here, you would be able to, we can hear you much louder mm-hmm. then. So just act like they're in the room and project your voice so that we can hear. So using a little reverse psychology on them, but it's just in how, you know what, they're people. They just need to be able, you're treating them just a little bit different, being able to share with them to have them to understand your understanding where they're coming from.
I want to make sure people also don't get this subliminal message of, you know, this is all about girls of color and girls living in really bad neighborhoods. Can you say something to our viewers that says, this is with all girls?
For us, we've been expanded. So we've worked predominantly over the last 8 years, mostly with school-age girls, elementary, middle school, and high school. But as our girls were getting older, we saw the need to be able to continue some level of structured mentoring initiatives on the college campuses. So we're in our second year of a pilot of Polished Pebbles at Duke University. And so there we've worked with undergraduate students and mentoring them with some on-campus events and e-mentoring. It's like the title of my book last year, They're All the Same Girl. So you're still dealing with girls who are dealing with the media issues, self-confidence issues, finding their voice and being able to speak up, whether it be in a job interview for a summer internship or just for having a conversation on the south side of Chicago. These are issues that any child deals with. And with if there's an absence of services of a public speaking class at their university or their school, I mean, where do you expect them to pick up the skill sets?
What was the name of that book again?
The name of the book is They're All the Same Girl.
They're All the Same Girl. I love that.
Because they are.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I just really want the viewers to understand that I think girls really experience a lot of different things than boys do.
Right.
I think it's tougher to be a girl than a boy, but just for all the things going
Hashtag
on.
Me too.
good. Just for both of you, maybe just a quick last thought. If you wanted one message to get out there to people about girls growing up today, what would it be?
Being able to have health self-esteem, being able to find a mentor, someone that you can look up to that can say they can help you with whatever it is that you need, because they're out there, and it's colorless. It has nothing to do with the color of a person's skin. It's as the Reverend Martin Luther King, the content of your character, how you're treating people, and that's all they need to know is have self-esteem, believe in yourself, and know that you can do whatever it is that you want to do in life. Just believe in yourself.
All right. Just one quick thought from you.
Together she shines. So it's not just the needs for people like Sharice and I who provide services. We need people from the civic community. We need public leadership. We need the business community to all play a role in providing support services and resources and volunteer mentors to impact girls.
Well, not only I want to thank you for being on the show, but I want to thank you for being good, strong role models for women.
Thank you.
For these girls coming up who are going to become women just like you two.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Lakeshore Focus airs on Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and it's rebroadcast on Sundays at 9:30 a.m. on Lakeshore PBS. Lake County and East Chicago could have new affordable housing by 2020 as part of a state tax credit program that's called Moving Forward. It's how officials can plan to fulfill a promise to help East Chicago residents who've been displaced by lead contamination. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek took a look last fall at the long-term effort and at what advocates say that officials should be doing in the short term.
Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority Executive Director Jake Sipe says Moving Forward tries to rethink affordable housing as about more than just a number of units.
We're defining success by the impact that we can have on the community that encourages economic development, but also thinking about the residents' success and how they can continue to be upward mobility on their economics and their jobs and their quality of life.
Sipe says the program started with a focus on transportation and energy, but has grown to cover the whole cycle of poverty and innovative ways to break families out of it. Developers chosen for the program have to hold a workshop to brainstorm solutions before deciding where to build. The latest Moving Forward focuses on Lake County, and Sipe wants at least one project to end up in East Chicago. Governor Eric Holcomb's 2016 emergency declaration for the city's lead crisis directed the State Housing Authority to spur affordable housing development in the area. As part of it, Sipe says they'll try something new at the Moving Forward workshop in November. They've invited two residents who were forced to leave East Chicago's badly contaminated West Calumet housing complex. Uprooted residents want first dibs on any new housing nearby, which Sipe says the state will keep in mind.
They're the experts when it comes to the types of housing that will provide them with the greatest opportunity to be successful.
Housing Justice Attorney Kate Walls has worked in East Chicago for more than a year and says residents need that voice if the state hopes to change their lives.
I think oftentimes what the mistake is with affordable housing design is they sort of come up with it first on their own and then apply it to the community without getting their input.
The developers tapped for moving forward in Lake County say they don't plan to do that. Pete Schwiggerod is a senior developer at Ohio-based Miller Valentine Group. He says they work with local nonprofits at the majority of their projects.
To simply house someone is only providing a good home, and to empower someone, you really need to have an approach that includes education and training and betterment systems.
The latest Moving Forward's other developer is Up Development, which ran Chicago's Cabrini Green Housing Project in 2008, when a rusty gate fell and killed a three-year-old boy.
I mean, it was a terrible tragedy.
Company president Jessica Burzak says Up and the city settled with the boy's family and learned a lot about managing and listening to tenants. That's why she says her company is excited to work directly with East Chicagoans.
I never want to impose a plan on a community or a person, but instead hopefully, you know, add good ideas to what they already desire for their own lives.
The community has plenty of ideas already, including on how public officials can help in the short term. East Chicago residents affected by lead have written to state, federal, and local officials asking them to pay for more relocation of former West Calumet residents and others. No agency has indicated they'll provide that funding, but attorney Kate Walls hopes they'll reconsider.
That's a standard, if not typical, use of federal and housing community development funds, and I don't think it would leave the state without more than enough resources to do other work.
Jake Sipe with the State Housing Authority says it's done everything the governor asked. Moving forwards, two Lake County developments aren't slated to open until around 2020. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Thanks, Annie. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. Reporters Roundtable Thursday is coming up tomorrow, and on the program, Dan Carton will have a State House report for us. He's with the Times of Northwest Indiana, and his Times colleague, Rob Earnshaw, will be with us with a Crown Point Roundup, and Joseph Pete, the business reporter for the Times, will have a Region Business Roundup as well. Hope you'll join us.